Welcome. This is the third in our series of Education Committee podcasts on GIS and what you might do with it in a future career. And today I have the enormous pleasure of having Joseph Kursky as my guest. I know Joseph now, I guess, since 2013 or so, when I participated in a teacher's workshop in Redlands at Esri. And since then, he has been the most amazing resource for me and for other educators. But he has a long and storied past, which I will let him describe more than me. But I will add here that he is the 2021 Lifetime Achievement in GIS Education Award winner from the University Consortium for Geographic Information Science. So right off from that triumph, and a man who has held many different positions within the GIS and geography world, let me introduce to you Dr. Joseph Kursky, I should say. So,
Well, thank you, Dr. Lazarus. It's great to be with you. I do appreciate the kind words. It's just a pleasure. I'm looking forward to chatting with you in the community.
So maybe we should start off learning a little bit about how you came to GIS. I know your fundamental love is geography and place, so that fits together. But how did you come to this?
Well, that's a great question. I just encourage the reader or the listener to think about some of these elements and how they can weave their own story into success with geography and GIS. In my case, I would say there are two things that influenced me as a young person. Number one, I love to get outside, and I grew up in Western Colorado, so I could explore mountains, canyons, buttes, mesas. I had kind of free rein to explore lots of different natural landscapes. You know, it's all about like what Richard Louv writes about, last child in the woods, getting out there on the landscape is so important when you're a kid. I'm kind of I'm sure many examples of loving getting out there on the landscape as a child, and that fostered into my love of geography as a young person and as an adult. The second thing, and this might be a little bit narrower in terms of not as many people having this experience, but I actually grew up in a motel because my folks owned it. My mother was also a school teacher, but my folks owned the motel, and probably people have been in hotels or motels where you know there's an apartment behind the office and that the people running the place are living there. That's the kind of place we had. So my whole family lived in this apartment, but I think meeting people that would stay there, and many of whom returned every summer, fostered my love for, you know, hearing about what people's backgrounds were and where they traveled to, where they were traveling from, and so on. So that kind of fostered an early love for people and places. And then the third thing that I'll mention here is that I would just encourage people to think about the following that you might do that nobody else in your circle of acquaintances or friends or even family members likes to do. In my case, it was making maps on big poster board. In my case, when I was a kid, from elementary on through high school, really, they evolved over time, but my maps eventually got into big poster boards. They were all hand-drawn. I had railroad yards and contour lines and address ranges. You know, what kid cares about address ranges, Paula? But I had all these made-up places with very detailed, mostly street-level geography on them. So I love making maps. Nobody else liked to do that I knew of. But again, you know, make some of those geeky, nerdy, unique things your own, and maybe that will fold into something that you actually do as a career. So that was three elements. Those were three elements that that I can point to that really fostered my lifelong love for geography and all things geospatial.
So that makes me laugh because the first thing I thought of when you said drawing maps was, and then there are many of you out there who like to do imaginary maps, the Tolkien maps, the Phantom Tollbooth maps, right? And how wonderful they are as a way for many of us to think about the world or a story. And in your work, the narrative has always tied very closely to your mapping work.
Indeed. And maybe some of your listeners have done this as well, those who are instructors, or maybe you had this experience as a student. I have my introductory geography GIS students draw hand sketched maps of their a place that was significant as a child. And then we have a discussion about how those are unique places and also how we're fundamentally tied to space and place. So as probably everybody listening to this can identify, if you think about a place that you spent significant time as a child, those are very large scale detailed maps, right? We can still recite from memory. We can draw them on a piece of paper or on an Adobe Illustrator, but it's fun to draw them on paper or some sort of physical media, where our friend's house was, where, how do we walk to school, our own neighborhood, our backyards, the vacant lot we spent time, the riparian zone, et cetera. So, but we're very fundamentally tied to space and place. And that's what makes us, you know, one of the unique things as humans is that we really care about these places and they stick with us the whole rest of our lives. Probably some element of that in the animal kingdom about finding their way home and so on and so forth. But I think it's a neat activity to use with students and gets them thinking about space and place.
I agree. If you live in an urban area, you can also draw your apartment, the inside of your apartment, or the block that you live on. And so each of those mm-hmm. things are different depending on the kind of experience in the neighborhood that you lived in. But once you were out in the world exploring with your geography background, you seem to have had experiences in many very different kinds of organizations that used your knowledge in different ways. So maybe you might share with us how different or what kinds of things you were doing in organizations like NOAA or the USGS or any of the other places that maybe folks don't think need GIS professionals.
Well, certainly I have had the privilege and really the blessing of being in four different sectors of society over my career. Nonprofit, so I was president of the National Council for Geographic Education. I love geography education. I'm active in AAG and EuroGeo and some other nonprofit organizations. So I've got a toe there. I've also had, as you mentioned, a significant number of toes in the federal sector, government sector, so NOAA, USGS, Census Bureau, as a geographer or a cartographer, and in the case of the USGS, and spent time gathering data and working with the public and in other roles, building geodatabases that we all can use now. A lot of those foundations were laid at those big federal science and mapping agencies. I've also been involved with academia. So since 1995, really been teaching at least one class per semester in different universities and colleges. Right now I'm teaching at the University of Minnesota, Harrisburg Area Community College, and Elmhurst University in Illinois, and also at the University of Denver. So I love that. I love keeping in touch with students, finding out what their needs are, what their challenges are. You know, I just love working with students, as many of your listeners like doing. And there's some students leaving now that I was just working with. You might hear them in the background here at the University of Salzburg in Austria. These are actually students. Bye, Totzins. Yeah, see ya. All best wishes. I'm saying goodbye to them right now. They are from the Netherlands, and they're down here in Salzburg for a 1 week. What a great experience as undergraduates doing field work. And then they presented their results today at the University of Salzburg. So they traveled from the Netherlands to Austria and did the field work and then presented about it. But anyway, perfect example for why we care about this. And then the last sector is, for me, private industry. So a company, ESRI, Environmental Systems Research Institute. So I'm on their education team, which is dedicated to helping students, faculty, deans, facility managers on campus, anyone be successful with geotechnologies and spatial thinking in their curriculum, in their advisement, in their research, in their facilities management. So again, private, public, nonprofit, and academia. So I'm very happy to be in this field. And you know, the encouraging thing for your listeners, I think, is that, well, there's two things. Number one, you can be valuable in lots of different sectors of society with geography and spatial thinking and geotechnologies on your tool belt. and as a framework for making decisions. You can be valuable. And the second, perhaps, nugget to take away from that is not to look at my background. It's just, but my background will hopefully encourage people that you're not stuck in one agency, right, Paula? You're not stuck in one organization for the rest of your career. Nothing wrong with that. But you have, again, these skills and abilities that you can move around and make contributions in many different places.
So what I'm hearing and what I find particularly interesting and fascinating, perhaps also useful for folks who are considering where they fit in the GIS world, is that that world is very broad, and that you can be, you do not have to only be a coder or only be an analyst. You can also be the person who is managing those groups or reaching out to others to teach them about the work that they do. And so I see in your career that you have a very wide range of talents there, from the organizational to the instructional to the actual doing, drawing of the map, whatever it happens to be. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I think you're raising a good point. We need the developers to forge new ground and to bring geospatial technology, remote sensing, GIS, GNSS, to the next level so that people can find it and discover it in lots of different disciplines where it previously hasn't been discovered. That's one of my passions, is bringing this to business and to history and to math, data science, civil engineering, et cetera. In other words, I love geography and environmental studies, as I know you do, but it's too valuable a tool to just be in one or two disciplines in society or even on a campus. It needs to be in lots of different disciplines. So that's one of my passions. And another aspect of what you're saying, I think, is important too, is that sure, we need those development folks that can blaze new pathways in geospatial technology and bring us the new tools, et cetera. But we also need people to apply it into different sectors of society, health, transportation, right, public safety, and in my case, education. So unlike maybe some of your listeners, I'm interested in using GIS. I'm not really that interested in developing tools. I develop things, but they're all for education in my case and for the benefit of others. I value the skills that people have to develop the new tools. I want to use those tools. I spent a couple years in coding, and I, again, have lots of respect for those people. I realized that that was really not my main passion. It was good to be immersed in that for a while, but yes, I love using GIS for making wiser decisions to understand our biomes, our ecoregions, our population change, our natural hazards, right? Our soil conditions, our climate and weather. I love you applying a geography through GIS to understand our world in a richer, deeper way. That's what I love about GIS. I don't love the technology just for technology's sake. Sure, it's very intriguing and interesting, but I really like what you can do with it. And so I love encouraging people to have it on their tool belt, not the only tool that they need, right? There are other skills and tools that they need. They need communication skills, skills in critical thinking, problem solving, analysis, spatial stats, right? The list could go on, as you and I have chatted about over these years. GIS being one of the key skills, though, for lots of different disciplines. It can't be ignored, because we're always going to ask the whys of where. We're always going to have perplexing, complex issues on our planet that are spatial, right, Paula? And we need to understand and solve those. Many of the trends in our world are going in the wrong direction, right? So we need to reverse those trends. And the way to do it, I think, is this holistic perspective of which geography brings. It's always been a holistic looking at the biosphere, connected to the lithosphere, connected to the atmosphere, connected to the anthrosphere, the human sphere, the cryosphere, the ice sphere, et cetera. The spheres, and also the cycles, the hydrologic cycle, the carbon cycle, and also looking at things as a system of systems. And so we need those people that have this holistic view that if we alter one variable over here in this sphere, it's going to change what, or potentially change this variable in this other sector or sphere. I think we need those holistic thinkers, which I think is one of the values of geography. It's also one of the reasons why geography is a bit misunderstood, but setting that aside for the moment. But we also need people at the same time to specialize. Nothing wrong with specialization. And we need people that understand soil really deeply, right? Metaphor of soil. We need people that understand geomorphology and population dynamics and river systems and climate and weather and so on, right? We need those, you know, that deep content knowledge for your listeners here. Don't hesitate to specialize, but don't lose the holistic and the spatio-temporal view of things.
So again, as I hear you talk, I realize why we've been friends for so many years, because my love of archaeology is because it is inherently super interdisciplinary. And I found that GIS was a very interdisciplinary world. And I see that this is also true in geography as well, right? That each of these fields and these tools really allow people to collaborate, to work with each other, to have different kinds of expertise that feed off each other. And so for me, that is one of the most exciting things about having GIS as part of my toolkit, because it allows me to ask questions that I couldn't otherwise, or would have been harder. I mean, we too mapped everything by hand with layers and layers of tracing paper for the different kinds of finds that we had in a particular site, right? And now we can do all of that having a geodatabase that allows you to analyze many more relationships than you ever could before. And of course, this is true whether you're working in rescue operations or you are working in, you know, for an oil spill, whatever it happens to be, right? You're looking at how are you getting the people there? You're looking at who's doing what kind of job, right? We see that GIS is being used more and more for management, right? And I don't think it was there when you and I were starting these kinds of things, but it is now offered people a way to think that's much broader than only I want to make a map of this.
Right. I think you're touching on some of the key trends in GIS over the years, going from the desktop to the cloud and being able to share methods, data, story maps, web mapping applications, dashboards to communicate the results of your research. I mean, those have been really transformational. When it was desktop only, it was really difficult for you and I and others to share data, to share methods. Absolutely. It was too clunky. We couldn't get it onto a disk. We didn't have enough hard drive, you know, too big to email, all these other constraints. And not that there's no constraints now. We still have some technological barriers, bandwidth and some other things, but it is vastly more accessible. And another aspect of what you're saying is that it allows people in other disciplines to embrace at least some of spatial thinking and geotechnology. So for example, when I'm working with faculty and students in school business, if they were at first initially hesitant saying, oh, that GIS stuff, it's over in geography or environmental studies or city planning, it's not me. But then when you dig deeper, it's like, well, what are you studying? What are you teaching in the school of business? Well, you know, supply chain management, target marketing, site selection, risk management. I mean, those are all spatial problems. And so hence, we'll call it location analytics for you business people then. Okay. Right. I don't need to have them learn every single thing about GIS. There are certain people that I think need to know a lot about GI science, but those school of business people, they don't need to know every single thing. I mean, sure, in my subtle way, I say, well, okay, if you're doing it, you know, a study of shipping across the Arctic, because, you know, there's not enough ice now and you'll be able to ship across the Arctic. I do want you to know about map projections. I do want you to not use Web Mercator up in the Arctic. So here's the thing called map projections, and here's a set of polar projections, et cetera. So I still nudge them a little bit into some of the core knowledge of GIS, but really what they want to do is map their target market. They want to be able to map consumer preference, who buys diet iced tea, who buys lottery tickets, who commutes to work by bicycle, who's donated to an environmental cause, who attends an art, you know, museum regularly, et cetera. And they want to map demographic trends, so population change, median age, et cetera. And they want to map their competitors, and they want to do drive times. They want to do routing. You know, they want to do some core things that a GIS can help them do, but they don't need really, and they don't have time to learn And nor should they have to do all of the GI science, right? Because what the nice thing is about modern geospatial tools is that you don't have to set your regular career as a city planner or an archaeologist or a business analyst aside for several years to become a GIS person, right? That was kind of the way it was. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but you had to kind of choose, right? If you're going to be the GIS person, that was pretty much your full-time job. And now, there's some deep knowledge required, but you can have that as a tool on your tool belt and still be the Nature Conservancy's wildlife biologist, you know what I mean? Or the City X planner, and have it on your tool belt and not have that be your full-time job.
Of course, there are people who need to know something about it because they are going to interface it and use it from the user end. That is, they're going to look at something that somebody produced for them, but they need to know how to read it and they need to know how to interpret it. And they may be the user of the already made story map or dashboard, right? They are the people that maybe look to see the Johns Hopkins COVID dashboard because they're looking at what's going on in their world. They only need to know how does it work and what are the numbers there and where are the ways that you can change mm-hmm. your views. They don't need to know how to make the dashboard. And so if they're in a business though where somebody is going to make the dashboard for them, then what they need is enough knowledge to tell somebody, I need to have these pieces and I want them to work in this way. And so that's another way of having knowledge about GIS also, to have enough knowledge to work with someone who's going to create the thing for you.
Certainly. And the nice thing about what you're saying too is that it provides the GIS geography community to show some leadership. You know, we can help those people gain some knowledge about what exactly you're looking at and how to interpret it and notice the symbology and the classification method. And that leads into number two. And that is, I always want people to be critical of the data. So that's another way that we can show some leadership. Those of us that have, deep knowledge about geography and GIS, we're still learning from others, but we are the leaders in this space. I mean, this came out of the geo community. So we can help our colleagues understand the reasons why, hey, just because it's a map doesn't mean it's perfect. And be critical of the data layers, especially nowadays with web-based GIS. I mean, I'm not pining for the old clunky days that we talked about a moment ago when it was desktop only and you only had a few data sets to pick from. Now, everybody's a data creator, right? They're not just a data consumer. So they can put data, for example, in the ArcGIS online content zone. There's no guard at the content door saying you cannot put your data. It's a completely open platform. And there are other open platforms as well, but anybody can put data there. Hence, you as the data consumer need to pay attention to the metadata, if there is any. And if there is, understand what it is and be able to use that to make a more informed decision. I really want people to be critical of the data. There's just still too much of, oh, this looks good. I've just made a map in 1 minute in ArcGIS Online, let's say, and these layers look good, so I'm going to use it. Okay, let's talk about that. Where did your data layers come from? I don't know. Well, maybe you better find out. Again, different purposes for different needs and different scale requirements and different levels of accuracy required. But I really, really want people to be critical of the data and understand where it came from, who created it, how often it was updated, what scale it was created at, and so on.
So that actually leads me to two other things. One is that I think, and maybe I'll be interested to know what you think about this. I think faculty who... or instructors who are helping people learning how to use these tools really need to encourage students to put in their metadata, whoever's doing this, to learn that part of the process is to put your metadata in there. And the same way you wouldn't use a website or you wouldn't encourage your students to use a reference that had no author, you shouldn't use online mapping materials that you don't know where they came from or what they are. And perhaps you should also use that uses line to say, this is a class project. So the people know, exactly. Maybe yep. I don't want to use this.
Right.
That's it.
And some of the data, maybe I know where you're going here. Some of the data that students create is actually quite good.
But you still want to know.
But still, yes.
What good it point. Is. What I wanted to say, where I was going with this, is so now there are so many more apps and ways to collect and share data. And I believe you have recently published something about crowdsourcing and how we trust it or not trust it. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, there's two things I'll mention here. One is I do with a colleague of mine who co-wrote the GIS Guide to Public Domain Data with me, Jill Clark. So she and I, when the book was published, we said, we've got to keep this conversation going. These elements that we're talking about are too important just to have in a book that's got a timestamp on it. Let's keep the conversation going. So we write about three things in this spatial reserves blog, basically. Where to find data, how do I know if it's any good, and number three, societal implications, copyright, ethics, location, privacy. I mean, as you know, location is inherently spatial and it's also personal. So there are all kinds of ethical and personal issues involved. Okay, let's talk about those. Why does the calculator app need to know my location on my phone? And if I say yes, does it matter if I say yes? If I shared my fitness app with the world, my walks and runs, you would be able to know where I live probably because I spend a lot of time walking around my own neighborhood as probably most people do. Does it matter? If I want my pizza to be delivered, I'd need to give my exact location. Okay. So I want people to think about all those things and even more serious issues about data quality, especially if you're making a decision that could have wide-reaching ramifications. So that being said, I'm really keen about getting people that kind of information. And the second element, I think it's important to show people that there's a lot of power in connecting these cloud-based, web-based geospatial tools. So on the crowdsourcing aspect, one thing that I've developed is a just kind of a simple example, but it shows people what you can do with connecting these apps and maps. So I have a walkability example where I have a simple survey 123 in this case about, hey, how walkable is this area that you're in right now that you want to share? Is it walkable or not? Rate the walkability, tick all the choices that describe it, you know, wide path or sidewalk, or are there branches or snow, or is it dangerous? Where is it? And do you have a photograph of it? So really five different simple elements in a survey 123. Then of course I map it. It feeds into a feature service. And then from that, I created a dashboard of it that keeps updating in real time as people fill out the survey. So like the Johns Hopkins COVID dashboard that you mentioned, which gets feeds from CDC and NOAA, or CDC and United Nations, the World Health Organization, and other sources, local governments. Mine only gets a feed from one source, and that's my own survey. And until I turn that survey off, right now it's for the general public, so anybody can fill it out. It's going to be online until I turn it off as the owner of that survey. And then the last thing I have besides the map, the survey, and the dashboard is a story map that links them all together. So inside my story map, I talk about, you know, what's walkable neighborhoods? Why do people care about walkable neighborhoods? I'm very passionate about that as a geographer. So every time I go on, you know, work travel or even fun travel, I'm always walking the neighborhoods to see how walkable it is. And, you know, there's a lot of places that claim to be walkable that have elements of not being walkable and vice versa. You know, I've found lots of walkable places in places that you wouldn't think. So it's a good thing. That's what maps always do. They challenge our sort of preconceived notions of how the world works. That's one of the reasons why I love mapping, right? I know you and I have talked about this over the years. They sometimes confirm your hypothesis about what a place or a space looks like. And oftentimes they challenge. Totzin, see you folks. Yeah, all the best wishes. I'm saying goodbye to some of the other students that I was working with. Sometimes they challenge and sometimes they confirm your preconceived notion of how the world works. So that's what's good about maps. They've always had a lot of information in a small amount of space, whether it was on clay tablets, right, and the Babylonians or Al-Idrisi's map on silver wood blocks, or more recently on film and then on paper and then in the digital world. They've always been lots of information. And then my walkability, circling back to that, gives a lot of information in a short amount of space. But linking those tools together, I think, are really powerful. Now, let's say your passion is not walkability. Maybe it's community gardens or community art or invasive species or water quality or tree species and condition in your area, or whatever, weather. I mean, there could be any topic that you would use the same with the same methods that I used, so that you can tell the story about that particular theme or topic globally or just in your neighborhood. So, you know, there's a lot of power in linking these WebGIS tools together.
Absolutely. So our time is almost up, but I'd love to give you the opportunity to, pardon me, plug your blog. So if you'd like to plug your, that wonderful blog website for open source data, please do. I can vouch for it. I've used it and taught with it. It is a fabulous site.
Well, many thanks. I do appreciate it. It's it's something that I think is very important to, for us to keep in conversation with students and also for the general public to look at. I've got some fun examples in there. They're not all geotechnology examples, but everyday examples of being critical of the data. I've got a picture from a magazine in there that's reversed. It's a map of the world and someone's pointing at it and it's flipped. You know, just stuff like that. Be critical. Grocery store, Atlantic salmon raised in Chile. What's wrong with this picture? Anyway, stuff like that. Everyday examples are just being critical of the data. So that's the Spatial Reserves data blog. Do a search on spatial reserves. Since you're giving me the opportunity, I'll also mention this. I've got a monthly podcast called Thinking Spatially. Be an excellent addition to Paula's podcast because it's all about geospatial thinking and geography and inventions, explorers, and other things that are geo-related. So I'll just mention those. And maybe the last one I'll mention is I do have an Our Earth video channel. I have 5,000 videos on it. So I'm rather passionate about all this. And they range from, you know, coastlines, mountains. So they're places, but they're also how to make a story map, how to make a dashboard. I've got geotechy things in there, but then I also have a lot of education things like how should we teach GIS? How should we teach geography? How should we teach STEM with digital maps? So I have a lot of that in there. It's called Our Earth. Thanks for the opportunity, Paula. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome. And I hope you will look for this podcast with our other podcasts for the New York State GIS Association Education Committee. And we have lots of other resources on that page too. And we will include Joseph's resources there as well. So thank you all very much. And thank you for your time, Joseph. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Paula. Good to see you again. Good to listen to your wonderful voice. And I wish you all the best in the future, all successes.